Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. Nuremberg State Executioner Meister Franz Schmidt maintained a daily journal between the years 1573 and 1617, recording each and every execution and corporal punishment he administered during his 40 years in service. While the details of the journal are gruesome, taken as a whole it reveals some fascinating aspects of Schmidt's views on crime, death, and God. Vanderbilt historian Joel Harrington, who has translated the journal from early modern German, is currently at work on a book about Schmidt. I began by asking Harrington why a 16th century executioner made such an alluring topic.
I was frankly surprised that an executioner would be literate, let alone keep a journal like this. That was a big shock for me. But the other thing that I think really attracted me to this project was his life story. I mean, here's a guy who is a professional killer. He's paid, as you said, to torture people and to execute them. And yet, in his lifetime, he is a very well-respected member of the community. He lives in a big house with his family. His kids go to the church school. By the end of his life, he's not only made a citizen of Nuremberg, which is a great honor, but he's also gets a special decree from the emperor declaring him to be honorable. And when he dies, he has quite a bit of property. He has a big state funeral. So I thought, how could somebody who comes from what most people would have said is the most odious profession around? I mean, it was virtually a kind of untouchable, that the people wouldn't have anything to do with him. They're legally disenfranchised. How does somebody from that background end up the way he did?
And what kind of things did you see in his journal that jumped out at you that you thought, this can't be real?
Well, again, I mean, for somebody from our century and our society, the level of violence is at first shocking. But I also, once I got into it, I saw a lot more similarities to our own society, and not just the alien parts. I mean, the things that are, of course, shocking are, as you said, there's judicial torture. And he actually does not write about the torture. That's something that he doesn't make any recording of.
He just records the executions.
He just records the executions. Actually, his journal is not really a journal either, I should say that. It's basically two lists in chronological order. One list is a list of all of his executions of various forms, and one list is all his corporal punishments. So things like flogging, but also cutting off somebody's ear or a tongue or something like that. So it's not a journal in the sense that he comes home and says, "Dear diary, I'm having second thoughts about this whole torturing on the rack thing, or maybe I should be in a different profession." It's not introspective like that. And no writers in the 16th century, except maybe somebody like Montaigne, are doing that sort of thing. On the other hand, it's what surprised me is when you really read it closely in his descriptions of these crimes and criminals and the stories that he ends up telling about them, is you really get more of a sense of the person behind this. And the person is not one of these anonymous, hooded brutes that we think of in the movies. He's somebody who is literate, he's learned, he's pious, he's a teetotaler, he doesn't drink at all, which actually is quite unusual for executioners, because executioners were reputed to be big drinkers. They often termed
specifically in the 16th century?
In the 16th, 17th century, a lot of times they would drink before they did the execution to steady their nerves. And they called it a magic drink, that it was a magical drink. And this is a kind of part of their background that I think Meister Franz was trying to get away from and trying to be much more of a cool professional.
Is he unique in that way?
I think there are certain aspects of his life that are unique. Certainly that he served for as long as he did. And he was active for 45 years, which is very unusual. That he was so successful, that he was so prolific in terms of his executions. But I don't think it's unique in the sense that what's going on in the 16th and 17th century, and this is part of the larger context of the journal, that this is a period where capital punishment and other types of criminal punishment take on more of a religious air. There's a need to legitimize these, to turn these into popular public morality spectacles. And the executioners play a really key role in this. So you can't, the executioners in the 16th and 17th century need to be somewhat more respectable than the people in the Middle Ages, who worked more on an ad hoc basis, were paid by the execution. people like Franz Schmidt, they're professionals. They're usually from executioner families. Some of these things really require a lot of skill. So beheading with the sword, which is one of the most common executions, these are really big, heavy swords, and to cut off someone's head with one swoop is, so I've heard, quite difficult. And, you know, a bungled execution could be very risky for the executioner. There are some stories where executioners take two or three times to chop off someone's head, and the crowd gets very ugly and storms the stage and sometimes stones the executioner. So there's a lot of performance pressure on the executioner. But to get back to the state authorities are very interested in having an executioner who is seen as part of a legitimate process as opposed to some kind of popular vengeance. They're very concerned about legality and the appearance of legitimacy and also the religious dimensions. So I think there are many more executioners like him during this period. Mm-hmm.
And that's a specific change that happens during the latter part of the 16th century.
This happens really, I think, in the 16th and 17th centuries, mm-hmm. and it has a lot to do with state formation and the growth of governments and the ambitions of rulers to do things. I think it's also influenced by the Reformation, undoubtedly.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. How that influenced Schmidt's life, how it influenced his inner life, how it influenced procedurally how executions were seen by the audience even.
Well, I mean, it's easier to talk about the execution and the religious dimensions of that because, again, in his journal, it's not deeply introspective. The execution itself is a quasi-religious ritual where the condemned person, who's called the poor sinner, is brought out, and you know, we've all seen this in movies and read about it, and marched out to the gallows. But the point of this is the execution is both to demonstrate the legitimacy and authority of the state government. It's to provide some sort of retribution to the individual who was killed or to the family or to the community. Mm-hmm. But it's also meant to provide a sort of religious lesson. That is that when you do these terrible things, A, you're going to get caught eventually, which was actually not the case. Most people got away. B, there's a possibility of salvation in the end, a very Christian message about forgiveness and reconciliation. And so in the journal, Meister Franz does make notation frequently when somebody died, well, he would say died well, but also died a Christian death, died repentant, and that gave him a sense of satisfaction, I think.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. You're listening to historian Joel Harrington talk about the journal of Meister Franz Schmidt, a 16th century executioner. I want to jump outside of Schmidt just for a second, because just to the broader topic of execution, it's a very public thing, obviously, yes. In the 16th century. And when does it start going so hidden and private?
It's not really until much later that, and this happens throughout Europe, that a lot of reformers and authorities say that these are not at all having the effect, these public executions that they're supposed to have, and the people treat it as a big party. A lot of people get drunk. It's meant to be something that scares people and prevents them from going into any kind of crime, and it seems to be counterproductive in that. Mm-hmm. That's part of the reason they decide to stop having public executions.
I wonder if you could read a few entries of Franz Schmidt's journal for our listeners.
Sure. One of the revelations I had when I did this is how much he changes over time, which is, of course makes sense. Most of us would over the course of 45 years. But that also helped me really get a sense of the person and the things that are changing in terms of his worldview. So here's the very first entry. And this was made in 1573. He's 18 years old. He's a journeyman executioner working for his father, who's also an executioner in the Prince Bishopric of Bamberg. Mm-hmm. And his first entry reads, "Begun at Bamberg for my father in the year 1573, June 5th. Leonard Rus of Zion, that's a small village, a thief, executed with the rope at the city of Steinach, was my first execution." And for the first few years, they're very brief like this. It really reads like a resume uh-huh. of a young professional trying to secure a permanent position. And that's exactly what it is. I mean, he's really making a list showing that he's got expertise in all these different types of execution, that he's got a lot of experience. And 5 years later, he actually is appointed the full-time executioner of the city of Nuremberg, which is quite a coup. I mean, it's really a great job for an executioner, and it has a great salary with it. Here are a couple more entries, and they do get much longer over time. I'm going to read some short ones, but they become actually little short stories where there are characters, sometimes a little dialogue. There's a context. He'll describe the setting somewhat. And again, you get more of a sense of his thinking, but also the things that really stand out to him as both shocking and admirable. Mm-hmm. So this is one also when he's a young journeyman, 1574. And this is his first relatively long entry, and I think it really tells you the things that catch his attention. Klaus Renkhardt of Feilsdorf, a murderer, committed 3 murders with his companion. First, he shot dead his own companion. Secondly, a miller's man who helped him to attack and plunder a mill by night. The third instance was again at a mill called the Fox Mill on the mountains, which he attacked at night with a companion, shot the miller dead, raped the miller's wife and maid, forced them to fry some eggs in fat and laid these on the dead miller's body, then forced the miller's wife to join in eating them, then kicked the miller's body and said, "Miller, how do you like this morsel?" Also robbed the mill, on this account executed on the wheel, and I can tell you what that is, at Greiz in the Archbishopric of Bamberg.
Wow.
And this, I should say, is a theme throughout the journal. These robbers are roaming the countryside virtually untouched by law authorities. And so he's very jubilant when they actually catch some of these people who do incredibly violent things.
Uh-huh. And maybe you can, before that, read the last one, maybe you could say what the wheel is.
The wheel is one of the few really gruesome executions to survive the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages had a lot of awful executions. I mean, they're all awful in a different way, but the wheel is one that's reserved for murderers, highwaymen, people who've committed great crimes, killed children, and traditionally it was done with a wagon wheel, where the executioner would take a wagon wheel, and the poor sinner, the condemned person, is staked out, and the executioner would use the wagon wheel to break as many bones as possible, sometimes 30, 35 blows.
And would the victim or the sufferer be tied to the wheel?
Well, in later time, that's what they started to do, is they tied the person to a wheel and they used an iron bar instead.
Okay.
But again, the idea is this is the only execution that's really, well, other than drawing and quartering, which is extremely, extremely rare. It doesn't happen that much. Where torture is actually a part of the execution. And this can be done two ways. They can say from the top down, which means if the judges wish to be merciful, the executioner will first do a blow to the neck or to the heart, killing the person, and then administer all the blows to a corpse. But if they consider the crime especially atrocious, it'll be from the bottom up, meaning that the executioner will try to prolong the death as long as possible. So this could be a really extended, gruesome spectacle, mm-hmm. which is the intention. this is another short one, just to give you another sample.
And this is from later?
This is 1597, so he is 42 years old. Hense Schwarz of Dienelbach, these are all villages, otherwise known as Clumsy, a thief, about 16 years old, stole much, cut 18 purses, executed here with the rope.
And this would also be watched by a crowd.
And this is viewed by hundreds or maybe thousands of spectators.
A few times, or maybe more than a few times, there are nicknames that he has for the people that he's executing. Are these nicknames that he makes up, or
no.
Are the nicknames that are the people are known in the community
these
as?
These are essentially their street names.
Uh-huh.
And many people had these. Not everybody who had a street name was a criminal, but almost all criminals, all people who were at least professional criminals, had some kind of nickname. Some of them had many nicknames. And he sometimes has an easier time remembering the nickname than he does the actual name, because that's the one that everybody knows them by.
This brings up one more question that you had mentioned before. He seems to have particular ire reserved for people that commit acts of fraud or deception or that disguise themselves as someone else.
Well, I think it's for him, it's part of his very concrete sense of justice. That is, he very much takes the perspective of the victim. And so a lot of his entries will write about the things that are done to the victim. And he's very indignant about that. And so, of course, violence and these terrible things that robbers do get him especially upset. But as you said, it's an aggravating aspect is deceit. people who come at night, people who take somebody in the woods and stab them in the back, people who slander others to try to get them convicted of a murder they didn't commit. I mean, these are things that he finds especially reprehensible. And I think it tells you something about him as a person, also how he thinks of justice, that is, as something that's based on being honest, which is what you would expect maybe from an executioner.
As an historian, you found some really interesting on-the-side sort of topics to go after. You've done a book about unwanted children during the 16th century. Here's you're working on a project now about an executioner and sort of his life and what one can read from that. Mm-hmm. Are there other projects you have in mind?
I think what I'm attracted to here is people that otherwise are lost to history. People whose voices you never hear, people whose faces you never see. And I'm attracted both to giving these people a voice and letting us learn about these perspectives, because they are a part of the society and the community as much as any king or bishop, but also the challenge of it. It's very difficult. These are mostly illiterate people, the ones I'm talking about, who don't leave a lot of records. So I have to work mainly with legal records and other sorts of records, and it's a lot of piecing together small bits of information, small bits of direct criminal testimony to really reconstruct a life. So I'm drawn, I think, to the challenge of that too, that it is difficult, but I think it's rewarding, because 16th century executioner, that is not somebody I would think I have a lot in common with, hopefully, or most of our listeners. But on the other hand, those are the sort of people it's important to find out more about.
You've been listening to an interview with Joel Harrington on the Berlin Journal. Coming up, novelist Francisco Goldman.
The wait is over. NPR Music is headed back to the South by Southwest Music Festival live from Austin, Texas. I'm Bob Boylan. Our coverage showcases some of the best new music with the adventurous pop band Spoon, as well as Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, Brooklyn Rider, Surfer Blood, Broken Bells, and much more. Hear their full sets and discover some of your favorite bands. Experience the South by Southwest Music Festival at nprmusic.org.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. Francisco Goldman is the author of three novels, The Long Night of White Chickens, The Ordinary Seaman, and The Divine Husband, and a work of nonfiction called The Art of Political Murder about the 1998 assassination of Guatemalan Catholic Bishop Juan José Girardi Canandera. Goldman, who was raised in Massachusetts and Guatemala, is now finishing a book called Say Her Name about his late wife, the writer Aura Estrada. Spiegel Online editor Michael Scott Moore began by asking Goldman about Aura's death and how the event brought him serendipitously to Berlin.
My wife Aura Estrada, age of 30, died in a swimming accident on the Pacific coast of Mexico on July 25th of 2007. And let's just say that in my life there's a very strong before and after now. I think everything that came before that, you know, for instance, the book I was working on at that moment, I just set it aside and haven't looked at it since. And I went into a period of complete paralysis, a lot of heavy drinking. Let's say I was drunk for 6 months. And this woman named Chloe Arigis, who is Mexican but writes in English as a young writer, and she was living here in Berlin. And out of the blue, it was really out of the blue, she said to me, "Look, I'm going to see my parents over Christmas and New Year's. Why don't you take my apartment for a month?" And I was desperate. I mean, the last thing I wanted to do was stay home with the ghosts, you know, in Brooklyn or, you know, over Christmas. So I came here and I didn't know anybody here. And I just holed up, you know, and it was perfect.
The book tells the story of your relationship, or
it tells every yeah it tells everything, you know. It's a book that when you have a loss like that, you're in possession of something very precious that you're terrified of losing, which is the memory of her. And inevitably, with the march of time, things are going to be lost, and so you feel this. And I felt this. And she was the most extraordinary person. She was a brilliantly talented young writer. You know, I really felt that I wanted people to know what she was like, you know, and almost as much for myself. You know, picture myself, if I live that long, you know, 40 years from now, you know, in this book, I'll be able to always find her. There's that great There's that line where Borges says somewhere that Dante wrote the Paraíso so that he could see Beatrice smile again. And that was a big part of that, like making her alive, keeping her with me. And then also, to tell my own story, because you realize that you have your world blown apart like this. You never imagine what it was like. I mean, I thought before this happened, I had some idea what mourning was like, or we had no idea.
There are very strong Gothic elements in your work. So I wonder if that comes into this novel, too.
It's true, My first novel begins with murder. It's on the first page. I learned writing that first novel. Never write a novel about a murder if you yourself don't know who committed the murder. I never forget when I finished that book at the end of the book, and it's like the kind of novel you get all the way through it, and you're really not sure who did it. And my editor said to me, look, it's okay if the reader at the end isn't sure who committed this crime, but do you know? You don't have to tell me, but do you know? I'd hate to think that was some sort of deep premonition in me. Part of it is that death has always been so present publicly in my life. When I'm 10, 12, 11, beginning to wake up to existence in a sense, that's the era in which big assassinations go on in the United States. Yeah. I was a newspaper boy on my bicycle, delivering newspapers for all those assassinations and seeing people open the paper and fall down to their knees practically because it's Massachusetts and I'm bringing them the news of the death of Bobby Kennedy and the war in Vietnam. So there's always this sense of kind of darkness like that. And as a very young person, I was drawn into the war in Central America. And so death inevitably became something I had to deal with as a writer all the time. And yet how different I thought. That's why I said earlier, I thought I knew what it was till it really comes and just blows you to pieces, you don't, I mean, some of my very, very earliest memories of fear. Like, I remember, I must have been 3 or something, being hugged by my mother in my bed while machine gun fire is, like, rattling out in the streets of Guatemala City. And I guess a coup d'etat was going on. Yeah. But then I became very much an American boy, playing football and everything else. And I had a very sheltered, typical suburban American existence, always with this strange element of summers in Guatemala and relatives in Guatemala. But it's not really till I'm just out of college. I moved to New York, very much fascinated by the whole explosion, interest in sort of Latin American writings. I thought, I'll go down to Guatemala. I've saved up $1,000 and stay in this little chalet I know my family has outside the city. In this polluted little lake. And I go down there like a blithe idiot. And my uncle says, are you crazy? You can't go out there. There's a war going on. The police station in that town was just overrun. I was so innocent. And I went and I lived in my uncle's house, sort of working on my crazy stories. Meanwhile, a war is breaking out all around me. 1979 was probably the most violent, bloody year of the repression in Guatemala City. Yeah. That's the year where the death squads go crazy in the city. It's cracked down on the urban guerrillas, cracked down on the students. And that was really like, for me, that was going down the rabbit hole and sent a couple of the stories off to Esquire magazine, which back then had a pretty good fiction reputation. And they offered me some fancy assignment, believe it or not, to go to Nepal. Write about Sherpas. I said, no, I want to go back and write about what's going on in Guatemala.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of a 10-year detour. It was an old-fashioned writer's education. Yeah. It was like, And so for years, I just, my short stories kind of began to dry up. I was just working as a journalist. I couldn't wrestle the horror and the anger and the indignation and political revulsion over the savagery of what armies like the Guatemalan army and the Salvadoran army did. Obviously, the practically criminal role of the U.S. in many of those years.
Yeah.
It was, how did that become fiction? How did you get to that point where, like a Gunter Grass or Garcia Marquez, you could balance death and love and horror and humor? And that took a lot of growing up.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. You're listening to Michael Scott Moore speak with novelist Francisco Goldman.
And in the meantime, you've written a nonfiction book that's actually influenced the politics in Guatemala.
Yeah, that was unexpected. You know, I mean, this is now this huge detour my life's on. I feel like I don't have any relationship to the fiction. I think I still have certain relationship to my first novel, because after all, it's a bit autobiographical. But it seems like some other person wrote those books. And now I've had this back-to-back books, two books I never expected to write, The Art of Political Murder,
yeah,
and Say Her Name. Both books reacting to deaths.
Yeah.
And
real deaths.
Real deaths, yeah. You know. When Bishop Harardi was murdered in Guatemala in 1998, it was really the most utterly shocking political murder. He was the beloved bishop who was the human rights leader of Guatemala. They had signed the peace accords. People thought Guatemala was past that. It really threatened to derail the whole peace process. And of course, it was followed up with the most sophisticated, adroitly carried out propaganda campaign to basically convince the whole country successfully that what had seemed so obvious before, that it must have been an army political assassination,
yeah,
wasn't true.
Yeah,
it was pure theater. It was, mm-hmm, it was like taking the whole country and immersing it in this long piece of theater.
Yeah,
which is something I think Germans have a memory of.
Right.
And disorientating the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And my friends got directly involved because my friends had been the people who had fought, I thought, you know, most heroically to get the truth out.
Yeah.
Both young reporters and young investigators and young church activists and young prosecutors and all people. I started off just doing it as an article for The New Yorker, partly because I wanted to research the Guatemalan church for The Divine Husband, my third novel. And of course, the thing just took off. I found myself in a position where obsessed with the story and realizing that my friends really, that I was at one point seen as the only person who could combat this propaganda campaign that was not just being orchestrated in Guatemala, but out of Spain, out of the newspaper El País.
Because you had one foot out of Guatemala and you could publish outside.
I could publish outside.
Yeah.
And I'd stuck with the story,
yeah,
and I'd become close to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became an obligation. And it was a fascinating story, I have to say. It was the most extraordinary murder case. And then so the book came out, and in the book I, of course, mention, it's not that even that big a deal in the book, but I mention that one of the seeming powers lurking behind this thing was the former head of military intelligence, kind of the Guatemalan guru of military intelligence, and a man really, I guess on the radio you have to say suspected of, or allegedly, yeah, tied to organized crime, General Otto Perez Molina. I never thought he was going to become this leading presidential candidate. I really didn't, you know, and he became the candidate of the far right, the strong hand candidate. And by this time I was like, by the time that really starts to take off, I'm deep in mourning. I'm not even paying attention to what's going on. And all of a sudden, I'm getting calls and this and that. And it turns out, yeah, that the book, because the book's out by then,
yeah,
is becoming this thing in Guatemala. To priests are waving the book around saying, you know, you can't vote for him. He has the blood of our brother in our hand. I'm here. You know, in the past, the very kind of very corrupt, power-dominated newspapers in the capital could really dominate how people got their news in Guatemala. All the TV stations are owned by either the army or these, mm-hmm, kind of right-wing zillionaire who's based in Miami. And, or these crazy family that owns the fried chicken franchise, Pollo Campero, who are also like ultra-right-wing extremists. And they dominated the media.
Yeah.
But what's happened now in Guatemala is that every family has immigrants in the States. And they all communicate via Skype and via email and via YouTube and via, and every little village you go to will have the computer with the video camera set up to it in the little, yep, the little grocery or stationery store where people go in and talk to. And so all the interviews I was doing for, like, you know, various radio shows or even some TV in the States are getting broadcast down in Guatemala,
wow,
sent by relatives.
Wow.
And so apparently this is spreading all over the place. Also, I have to say, you don't know what uses people are going to make of your book. The opposition candidate certainly exploited that,
yeah,
you know,
sure,
made leaflets, and, you know, this book says that. So anyway, he ended up, the presidential candidate, Perez Molina, did all kinds of horrible things to me, bellowed that he was going to sue me. I knew that he was probably, I thought it was very telling that he didn't sue me, because I don't think he could win.
We should say that The Art of Political Murder is about the death of Bishop Harardi shortly after the release of a report about atrocities.
Right, which broke all the taboos against implicating the military in the human rights. 250,000 murdered civilians, most of those in the 1980s. The peace accord said that the military had to turn over control of the Guatemalan security apparatus,
yeah.
military intelligence, and so forth, the civilians. They haven't done it. They gave themselves an amnesty. Bishop Hardy's report led to, eventually, a UN declaration through a UN report charging the Guatemalan military with having committed crimes against humanity, which technically undoes the amnesty. These kinds of people, generals, colonels, former military intelligence people, can use these state institutions to really create a country that almost can operate like Federal Express for the Colombian narcos, in terms of moving everything up from Colombia into Mexico. So that the DEA says 70% of narcotics, that cocaine that eventually reaches the U.S. moves to Guatemala.
Yeah.
You know, it's an eyelash from being a failed state. There's not an institution that organized crime hasn't taken over.
Thank you for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with novelist Francisco Goldman. After the break, Professor of Religious Studies Charles Marsh talks about Dietrich Bonhoeffer's 1930 visit to America.
Whether it's listening to the latest Life in Berlin feature, reading our opinion commentaries, following our Facebook conversation, or discovering weekday program highlights on our homepage, nprberlin.de is your pipeline for an inside view about our news and information service. There for you every day. nprberlin.de.
Back with the Berlin Journal. The German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer went to America in 1930 for postgraduate study at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. There he studied with Reinhold Niebuhr, learned of African-American spirituals in Harlem, and began to see religion from the view of those who suffer oppression. Charles Marsh, a professor of religious studies at the University of Virginia, is currently at work on a new Bonhoeffer biography, the first to be published in decades. I sat down with Marsh to talk about how American life infiltrated the German theologian's thought.
Before 1930, Bonhoeffer proved himself to be an up-and-coming young theologian in Berlin. He had finished two doctoral dissertations. His first had received the praise of the great Karl Barth as a theological sensation, a theological miracle. He was a straight arrow academic with his eyes set on sort of professional fame and fortune. But he was also a bit unsettled and restless. And it appears that he was in some way looking for a more vital connection between his academic work and life. So he came to the United States for an academic year in New York City, 1930-31. As a visiting student at Union Theological Seminary. It's not clear that he had really any big expectations for enlightenment during his year in the United States, but through a variety of interesting encounters and experiences, the year proved to be transformative in his own journey to reality, as Friedrich von Weizsäcker once said. 10 months later, he returned to Berlin with a commitment to make a direct connection between the classroom and public life. And it was because of this variety of experiences in New York. First of all,
what were some of
those experiences? It's wonderful that we have this picture unfolding now. The first is, you know, his encounter with professors at Union Theological Seminary. Union in 1930 was the flagship institution of mainline Protestantism, represented no better than by the indefatigable Reinhold Niebuhr. Reinhold Niebuhr really became one of America's prominent public theologians in the mid-20th century. Bonhoeffer found Niebuhr's theology perplexing. He took classes with him, and as a sort of a Germanic-trained philosophical theologian, he was puzzled by Niebuhr's, you know, idea that theology should really have direct social value. And so Bonhoeffer the Lutheran thought that, you know, New York and American theology didn't have all of its categories straight. But Niebuhr really pushed Bonhoeffer to think more concretely about the social consequences of religious belief, and to think about how to apply religious ideas to human rights, to civil rights, to human flourishing, to healing the social order. The other experiences Bonhoeffer had were, I would say, with the what we might call the encounters with the American organizing tradition. Union at that time, and really for the next several decades, produced several generations of progressive sort of grassroots Protestant organizers in the labor movement, in the women's movement, later in the civil rights movement. And Bonhoeffer became friends with several men who ended up being some of the greatest sort of organizing visionaries of mid-20th century America. I think of James Dombrowski. More importantly, I think, Miles Horton. I mean, Miles Horton was a country boy from East Tennessee who once said he was accepted at Union Theological Seminary only because they were looking for a token hillbilly. And he was a character that Bonhoeffer had never encountered in the ethereal world of German academe. And yet the two, against all odds, became very close friends. Horton and Browski and some of the professors at Union were leaving the Union quadrangle to go into the city, to work in housing, to work with the ACLU, to work with the NAACP, to get involved in social reform. And it was through these encounters, I think, that Bonhoeffer began to think more broadly. His moral imagination was widened, and his whole understanding of his vocation was transformed. I'd like to also point out that after Miles Horton graduated from Union Theological Seminary, he went and with this other visionary, James Dombrowski, established a training center in the mountains of East Tennessee called the Highlander Folk School. And many people will know the Highlander Folk School as the school that trained a generation of civil rights activists, including Martin Luther King Jr., Septima Clark, Ella Baker. In the 1930s, it was primarily organizing around the labor movement. Bonhoeffer kept up with these friends. They taught him a new way of thinking about the vocation of a theologian. And I think the most decisive encounter of that year was Bonhoeffer's engagement and intense six-month immersion in African-American spirituality and culture. A young African-American seminarian, Union had a diverse faculty at the time, and student body, named Frank Fisher, befriended the young Berlin prodigy. Frank Fisher was a minister's kid from Alabama who gently led a Bonhoeffer into this intense, joy-filled world of the Black Church.
Where was that?
He introduced him to the historic Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, where Frank Fisher, this Black seminarian, was working as an intern. And in time, Bonhoeffer started teaching, you know, in his fine German Berlin tailored suits and silk ties. He began teaching a Bible class for boys, a women's Wednesday night class. The esteemed Adam Clayton Powell Sr., who was the pastor at Abyssinian, had Bonhoeffer preach several times. Bonhoeffer became deeply immersed in the literature and the culture of the Harlem Renaissance, which was, of course, flourishing at the time. And at the end of the school year, In the spring of 1931, Bonhoeffer actually drove through the Deep South in a third-hand car with some friends at the time of really one of the bleakest times in the iron rule of Jim Crow. Driving near Scottsboro, Alabama, weeks after the trial had convened in the horrible case of the Scottsboro defendants. And in his notes from the Union year, increasingly it is the black experience. It is the discovery that in the United States, the most authentic representation of the Christian faith is found on the margins. It's found in the what Bonhoeffer once called the exuberant joy and the melancholy of the black church, of the preaching, of the worshiping. Bonhoeffer had never experienced that kind of exuberance in the sort of melancholy of the North German plains. And for him, it was his first encounter with a kind of embodied spirituality. It enabled him to sort of think of ways in which the interior life of faith ought to shape a new kind of moral disposition. One of my favorite images of Bonhoeffer's later work in the German resistance is that of Bonhoeffer standing around the piano at one of the illegal seminaries he ran on the behalf of the Confessing Church, with a gathering of sort of earnest Lutheran seminarians with their glasses of beer, singing Go Down Moses, and some of the spirituals that he brought back with him from New York. He brought back a collection of albums, and it became a very vital part of what he called, what Bonhoeffer called, my turning from the phraseological to the real.
This is R.J. McGill for the Berlin Journal, talking with religious studies professor Charles Marsh.
Did he have criticisms of America? There were these three things that influenced his life profoundly, and as well as his thought. Were there things about America that he was not so excited about?
You bet. He had contempt for much of mainline Protestant Christianity, and no interest at all in American Protestant theology as taught at Union Theological Seminary. He thought that Americans sort of ordered their religion the way someone might order an automobile to suit their taste and preferences. He said that I feel like I'm talking to schoolboys in one of his notes about his conversations at Union. He was outraged one day after giving a presentation on, the Protestant reformer Martin Luther's great doctrine of the bondage of the will, when the other seminarians at Union started giggling. They thought the notion was so funny. It was just sort of outrageous for Bonhoeffer. And he didn't really have much respect for what he thought was a kind of thin, weak theology that was really more about social utility and progress than really about preserving the great doctrines of the faith. I'm not sure his criticisms of American theology changed that dramatically in the course of the year. And so I think when Bonhoeffer goes back to Germany and he begins saying things like, grace without obedience is cheap, or when he says that faithful spirituality requires responsible action in the concrete here and now, that in some important way he is influenced by the spirit of American social theology, though perhaps not so much by the substance of American social theology.
You've mentioned that Bonhoeffer was pretty deeply engaged in German idealism, that he was fully engaged in looking at the tradition of German idealism from Kant onwards. Did America concretize him in some way? His mm-hmm. thought bring him out of abstraction, or were these abstractions still a fascination for him?
That's a great question, because in Bonhoeffer's academic writings, say those writings that he he completed between 1927 and 1930. I mean, two doctoral dissertations by the age of 24. Both published, both ambitious works that, you know, attempted nothing less than the, you know, deconstruction of the whole German philosophical tradition. Bonhoeffer was sketching out this idea of the human self that was an alternative to that of the philosophical tradition. And it was about a self in relation, in social relation. It was very similar, I would say, to the way that Martin Buber, for example, described the basic relation in his important book, I and Thou. That human selfhood is not constituted primarily by the self's own interior relations, but it's constituted by ethical relations, by social relations, by being in community. Some of his notes before he comes to New York, there seems to be a slight desperation that he's looking for something real, he's looking for something embodied, he's looking for something enfleshened. And I do think that it is, you know, encounters and experiences in the United States, but primarily with the Black church and with the encounters with African-American spirituality, that for him, you know, illuminates this new possibility and enables him to loosen, you know, boundaries and to cross boundaries and to achieve a deeper integration of spirituality with embodiment.
We come to subjects sometimes because somehow they remind us of ourselves. How did you, growing up a young white boy in the segregated South, how did that influence your own thought? You've written several books about this, about civil rights.
I grew up in the Deep South and came of age in a town called Laurel, Mississippi, which when my father was a big-hearted Southern Baptist minister, assumed the pastorate of the First Baptist Church there, was regarded by the FBI as the epicenter of Southern terrorism. It was the headquarters of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi that orchestrated numerous murders and beatings and really prevailed over a five-year campaign of terror. And when we moved to Laurel in 1967, this really was the most intense season of Mississippi burning. And so I have always sort of been haunted by those experiences, and yet in graduate school and sort of the theory-drenched academy of the 1980s, you know, I was working primarily with postmodernist theory and a philosophical theology that gave me no opportunity to kind of think back through some of those real historical, psychological, emotional questions that were very much unresolved. And I came to Bonhoeffer, again, out of my own desperation. And Bonhoeffer, at that point in my intellectual journey, illuminated for me a pathway back to life.
Your most recent book, Wayward Christian Soldiers, does a sort of thing that you admire in people like Paul Tillich or Reinhold Niebuhr. It engages from the liberal Christian tradition what is happening with religion or the claim to religion in the United States. As someone now that is a voice in liberal Christian tradition in America, what has happened to religion, and why has it been sort of cornered by the Christian right?
I wrote Wayward Christian Soldiers in 2006, 2007, at the height of this kind of extraordinary marriage between political establishment and conservative Christianity. And I wanted to write this both, you know, as a protest by a Christian theologian against this kind of enormous display of cultural and political idolatry, but also as a kind of marker, of a historical moment. I really believe that future historians of the faith and of religion will look at these years in American political life between 2000 and 2008 as one of the most egregious examples of the Christian faith's enslavement, our bondage, our captivity to partisan ideology. And so I wanted to both wage a theological protest against that, but also to mark that as a moment, a decisive moment, I think, in Christian history. I want to say this, however, that I do believe that the Christian right's hegemony over politics and public life has waned. I believe that one of the heartening observations that I've made in the past 2 years, as a professor at a major public university, and as someone who speaks often on college campuses, is a new generation mm-hmm. of people of faith, of men and women who observe these colossal theological mistakes made between 2000 and 2008. This kind of Faustian bargain that the Christian right made, you know, in exchange for political access and power, the Christian right would kind of offer up its blessings and it, you know, the resources of the Christian tradition in service to the state. And it would bless the invasion of Iraq. It would bless the invasion of this kind of monolithic conservative agenda. And I think a generation of students, of people of faith, saw that for what it was and are seeking something more authentic. I mean, Robert Coles, one of your friends and one of my heroes, has remarked that there is a resurgence of moral energy in the youth of the United States. And I'm seeing that at my university, seeing that across the nation, that students are, for example, they're hearing the stories of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. They're hearing the stories of the civil rights movement. They're hearing the stories of some of these great men and women who were, you know, progressive religious activists in the 30s and 40s. They're reading Achieving Our Country by our friend Richard Rorty, and they're thinking, we need to do something better.
Charles Marsh, thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
RJ, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Religious Studies Professor Charles Marsh of the University of Virginia about the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We also heard interviews today with historian Joel Harrington and novelist Francisco Goldman, who was interviewed by Michael Scott Moore, author of the novel Too Much of Nothing, and of a forthcoming book about the global spread of modern surfing called Sweetness and Blood, due out this June. The Berlin Journal is a production of the American Academy in Berlin and National Public Radio. For more on the American Academy in Berlin, please visit americanacademy.de. And for more on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide, please visit our website, nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Ralph Martin in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill. Thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal.